Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. India and Pakistan were on the brink of war last week. For the first time since 1971, Indian aircraft crossed into Pakistani airspace and bombed what India said were terrorist bases. The sudden escalation in tensions between the two countries had the world on edge. I mean, India and Pakistan are, after all, two nuclear powers that share a border and a 70-year history of mutual hostility. The U.S. has critical interests in the region, and so does Russia and China. But how many more flashpoints can India and Pakistan endure before they go to war once more? This hour on Point, India, Pakistan, and how to preserve a fragile peace between two nuclear powers. And you can join us. Have you been following the news out of South Asia? What's your reaction to the flaring of tensions between these two nuclear neighbors? Can the U.S. still be the best diplomatic broker in the region? Well, we're going to start today in Delhi, India. And joining us now is Maria Abi Habib, South Asia correspondent for The New York Times. She's been writing extensively about India and Pakistan, and we have links to her recent stories at onpointradio.org. Maria, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was wondering, Maria, if you could actually just start out. I want to start out with a little timeline of sort of how we got to today. Beginning on February 14th, so in the middle of last month, and a suicide bombing attack on members of the Indian military. Can you tell us what happened there and why that started off this rapid escalation of tensions between India and Pakistan?
So on February 14th, a young suicide bomber traveled about 10 kilometers away from his home in Kashmir and decided to attack a convoy of Indian paramilitary vehicles, about 70 of them. They were sitting ducks, basically. Usually military convoys do not travel in such large numbers. This suicide bomber was able to kill at least 40 paramilitary officers. Why that's significant is, first of all, there was over 100 kg of explosives that he used. Secondly, it also showed that he's a local. He's a Kashmiri. So what had happened was India's heavy-handed policies in Kashmir have led to a organic insurgency sprouting up there. Before that, Pakistan was kind of sending fighters from across the border that were slipping in. But many observers say that India's overreach in trying to crush this insurgency has actually led to an organic insurgency. So this was significant for that reason. That then brought India to say that they were going to strike back at Pakistan because this insurgent was part of a group called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is based in Pakistan. It's supposedly banned in Pakistan but operates freely, as do many other terror groups that the Pakistanis say do not operate in Pakistan, but there's clear evidence that they do. So that was the first flashpoint that really kicked everything off.
Right. And it's interesting. We should note that in years past, there have been terrorist attacks in India, significant ones on the Indian parliament and, of course, the Taj Hotel in Mumbai. But this attack on February 14th is the one that prompted the Indian government to send aircraft into Pakistan for the first time since 1971 to attack what it was saying was a terrorist base. But of course, locals on the ground in Pakistan said they didn't really hit anything at all. Can you tell us what exactly happened?
So then last week, the Indian Air Force sent jets in across what is called the line of control into Pakistan for the first time in about five decades, as you said. And they targeted what they said was a Jaish-e-Mohammed terrorist training center. They're now calling it a nerve center. But it's very unclear what they've hit. They've been reluctant to provide any imagery. Usually armies like the U.S. military, for instance, will provide imagery to say, look, this is what we hit. This is how successful our strike was. Instead, India just asked everybody to take them for, you know, to take them by their word. There have been conflicting statements from the government. Some have said, you know, there's been large quantities of terrorists that were killed. The Air Force chief yesterday said, we cannot comment on how many terrorists were killed. That's not for us to comment. So there's been lots of vague statements. Meanwhile, people that we, the New York Times and many other outlets, have spoken to on the ground in that area where the strike happened, say, hey, you know, they hit a ravine, an empty ravine. Mm-hmm. There is a Jaish-e Mohammed school, but they didn't hit it.
Right.
So there's lots of confusion and very few answers, unfortunately.
Right. Well, and we should also note that Pakistan said that it downed two Indian fighter jets, had captured an Indian pilot whom was later returned to India here, to India, I should say. But Maria, tell us, what was it about this particular set of exchanges that seemed to put the entire region on edge so quickly that another war might break out?
Well, first of all, now they have, both powers now have nuclear weapons, right? So the last time that they went to the brink like this, the last time that they had, you know, an aerial dogfight, the last time they were, you know, slipping into each other's, you know, airspace to try to bomb each other to smithereens, that was in the 70s. That was before they both had nukes. Now they have that capability. So that was what was so hair-raising. Secondly, where was the U.S. in all of this? The U.S. came out very, very late. They've been, you know, typically the Americans have played an important role, diplomatic role, shuttling between the two, telling both of them, like, look, you know, cooler heads must prevail. The U.S. seemed very slow in its response. And when it did respond, it was a good response, and it was very forceful, saying both sides need to come to the table. But it was quite late, and it was pretty much those forceful statements which then lead diplomacy and tell you, you know, tell both sides, like, hi, we're signaling here with these statements coming out of the State Department, for instance, signed by Mike Pompeo.
Mm-hmm.
Without that happening, you know, without preempting Indian and Pakistani actions, you can't control the narrative. You can't control the way you want things to go. So what happened was there were statements that came out kind of after the fact, once these aerial invasions and dogfights had happened. So people were kind of scratching their heads, wondering where the U.S. was in all of this and why there was no de-escalation measures that were taken aggressively.
Okay, so we're going to explore that more a little later in the program today. But Maria, finally, tell us, I mean, what is the immediate aftermath in India and Pakistan about with this sudden spike, dangerous spike in tensions here? I mean, people were looking to the upcoming elections in India as one of the reasons why Prime Minister Modi may have been, you know, more quite willing to act so aggressively towards Pakistan.
Well, Prime Minister Modi was also willing to act aggressively when India was last hit in 2016. So, I mean, Prime Minister Modi has proved himself to be very aggressive on Pakistan. So I wouldn't link his aggression necessarily with elections. Maybe, I mean, there could be a case to say that maybe he was more aggressive, but I wouldn't say that he's, you know, said that he was going to roll over when it comes to Pakistani aggression. But the elections, I mean, this has really changed the conversation inside India ahead of the elections, which are slated for later this spring. They haven't been called yet. Before any of this happened, before February 14th, the initial suicide bombing that triggered this larger crisis, everybody in India was talking about where are the jobs that Mr. Modi has promised.
Mm-hmm.
Because unemployment is so rampant inside India that you need to make about 1 million jobs per month in order to take on and absorb the youth that are coming onto the job market every month. That's a huge task. And he was elected in large part to take that task on because he said he was going to embrace the capitalist measures that India had been kind of, you know, shelving for so long in order to have a robust economy. So as soon as this happened, you know, it changed the conversation entirely, and nobody's talking about the the chronic underemployment and unemployment in this country. Now there's lots of chest beating, nationalistic slogans, and kind of us versus them. And that's happening from both sides of the border.
Well, Maria Abi Habib, South Asia correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Delhi, India. Maria, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's listen back to a little bit of the language coming out of both the Indian and Pakistani governments last week. On February 27th, a day after India sent those fighter jets into Pakistani airspace, the Indian Minister of External Affairs, Sushma Swaraj, spoke at a foreign minister's meeting in China about India's plan, saying that the nation would act with restraint and claiming that India would also de-escalate tensions between it and Pakistan.
This was not a military operation. No military installations were targeted. The limited objective of the preemptive strike was to act decisively against the terrorist infrastructure of Jaish-e-Mohammed in order to preempt another terror attack in India. India does not wish to see further escalation of the situation. India will continue to act with responsibility and restraint.
Well, on the same day, February 27th, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan confronted Indian leader, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and announced that Pakistan had shot down two Indian jets after they crossed over the border.
We decided to take action today. We only wanted to show India that we're able to. And if you come into our land, we will always retaliate. Two Indian jets had crossed the border and they were shot down. I will say the pilots are with us. The problem is, where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? Well, joining us now is Adil Najam. He is Dean of the Boston University Frederick G. Pardee School of Global Studies. Dean Najam, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us, in your estimation, we've got 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, though. How close were India and Pakistan to a war?
Once the jets start flying, once they start dropping bombs on each other, once you're capturing each other's pilots, that's nearly war by every definition. And this was as close as you've come. What I'll add to Maria's excellent analysis is it's not just the first time since 71. This is the closest we've come to nuclear war since Cuba.
Since Cuba. Okay.
Anywhere in the world.
So we're gonna pick up on that thought when we come back. We are talking about India and Pakistan and how to preserve a fragile peace between two nuclear neighbors. What's your question about this very important region? We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about India and Pakistan and how last week the two nuclear powers came very close to war and how to preserve the fragile peace between two key nations in South Asia. They are the nations of South Asia. I'm joined today by Adil Najam. He is Dean of the Boston University Frederick G. Pardee School of Global Studies. And Dean Najam, before the break, you were saying how it's so funny, in the week of news that we had last week, maybe a lot of people missed this, but tell us a little bit more about why you say it's as close as we've come to nuclear war since Cuba. I mean, that's quite a statement.
It is, but if you think about that, you know, we've had sort of deterrence work. And here is where deterrence nearly did not work. And I think it is mostly, as Maria also said, because we were so distracted last week. This wasn't a good week for nuke watchers, right? First, the phantom promise of an agreement, nuclear agreement with North Korea doesn't happen. And while that's not happening, this very real escalation happens. And I think it went off script. There was a script that in previous such incidences, for example, in 2016, which was that India would make a what's called a preemptive strike, kind of a tit for tat. Pakistan, in this case, kept saying, if you do this, be very careful. And usually what happens is the rest of the world comes in and says to both of them, okay, even if India makes a strike, everyone calm down. Mm-hmm. You know, get back to normal. This is too serious. Well, this time, no one came. The U.S. was missing in action. The rest of the world was distracted, disengaged, uninterested.
So I'm curious about whether or not that means that a war between these two nations is ultimately inevitable.
I hope it's not inevitable, but I think we are at a new abnormal. I think Mr. Modi wanted a new normal, which is I'm now a major power and I'm Mr. Modi. I can this time not just send artillery, throw bombs. I'll send my plane into your territory.
Right.
The miscalculation happened that I think the sense was that once he did that, the rest of the world will come and calm down Pakistan and say, okay, you're kind of even now, step back. In this case, no one came and Pakistan retaliated. And that's brought it to this new, what I call a new abnormal. Mm-hmm. Because now what that means is every future incidents, this is going to be the baseline it starts from, right? The previous baseline was incidents happen. I throw a few bombs at you across the line of control. You throw a few bombs across the line of control. We both beat our chest, tell our people how good we are, and we move on. Now, once planes start flying, then a lot of it is not in your hand. For example, if either of those two planes had ended up differently, right? Mm-hmm. If when Pakistan went in, India had sort of downed that plane instead of Pakistan downing the Indian plane. Think of what options would be with Pakistan. It would have escalated further. And once you go up the escalation ladder, the ultimate point has to be nuclear conflagration between the only two nuclear rivals in the world who are also neighbors. So in this case, you know, Mohid Yusuf has a wonderful book called Brokering Nuclear Peace. Deterrence used to mean two major powers deterring each other.
Right.
And what he argues is unless there's brokering by the major powers, that old calculus doesn't work. And in this case, it nearly didn't work.
It's more than a little shocking to hear that within basically a day or two, we could have such a dramatic escalation.
The positive note, within a day or two, while the world was sleeping, they also de-escalated. Right, you wouldn't have noticed it from the media, but the fact that the Pakistan Prime Minister did this very un-South Asian thing, going on television saying, I'm going to return this pilot mm-hmm. without conditions as a peace gesture. Mr. Modi beat his chest in his election and all that, but they also sort of the government, both governments did realize just how serious this was and this time did step back. But that's not something you can count on.
Well, I want to play a moment from Prime Minister Imran Khan's address, a television address. Again, he's the Pakistani Prime Minister. This was February 27th. He was talking, in a sense, directly to Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, saying that neither nation could afford a major war.
جتنی بھی دنیا میں جنگیں ہوئی ہیں بڑی بڑی ساری جنگوں میں
Imran Khan there saying all the major wars in history were miscalculated. Nobody considered where the events of war would lead to. So I ask India what sort of weapons we both have. Can we afford any miscalculation? But Adil Najam, let me ask you. So yes, so perhaps coming to the brink there, but stepping back. But what I really want to explore is what you were saying a little earlier, that this new abnormal, that we have a situation now that India and Pakistan have essentially been building to over many years, where on the one hand, Pakistan continues, for example, to deny its sheltering of terrorist groups, denying it to the world, even though many of global nations will point to Pakistan and say, that's simply not true. We have India rising as a power, and perhaps, as you're saying, being more willing to express that power militarily in the region, and also being seen, and the United States as itself has said that India is an important military power in South and Central Asia as a stabilizing force. So if those are the aspects of this new abnormal, what will it take to change? Because certainly there's going to be another terrorist incursion into India. What's going to stop India from escalating once again?
It's clearly not a stabilizing force. It's clearly not a stable neighborhood, right? Think about the neighborhood. It's not just India and Pakistan with nukes. Right on the north of them is Russia, nukes, China, nukes, Afghanistan, which is essentially the U.S. at this point. Right, and next door, Iran. So this is not a neighborhood where you want to be experimenting close to powder kegs. However, what will it take? It will take some really, really tough decisions, you know, in this by both countries. In your intro, you said, what will it take to preserve a fragile peace? Mm. I think what it will take is to stop trying to preserve a fragile peace and build a real peace. What does that mean? One, on the Pakistan side, one of the big lessons was that On the extremist groups and militant groups argument, it sticks very easy on Pakistan. So there is nearly no one in Pakistan who at this point believes that this incident or in the Indian response was really because of the militant group. However, there is nearly no one in the world who doesn't believe that it is so.
So a giant gap in belief there.
Pakistan, I think, has to somehow convince the world by its actions that this is not so, because otherwise, I think that was partly the thing, reason behind the silence. On the Indian side, the 70-year-old wound of Kashmir simply cannot be ignored. Amongst the many, many tragedies of this incident is that the thing that caused it has totally gone out of the radar screen. And in some ways, the world cares about India and Pakistan because they have nukes, and it becomes about India and Pakistan and not about Kashmiris. And the type of atrocities we've seen both in the build-up to this and post this event, you know, when people who are Kashmiri are being pulled out of shops and sort of nearly lynched just because they happen to be Kashmiris, I think unless that is solved. So this is not an easy ask. It is not, but Pakistan really has to change the world's perception by its actions on the militant angle. And India cannot. There is no universe in which you can be a respected global power unless the Kashmir issue is somehow resolved.
These are very big asks, as you say. Okay, so Dee Najam, stand by here for just a moment, because I want to bring into the conversation Aparna Pandey. She is director of the Initiative on the Future of India and South Asia at the Hudson Institute. Her op-ed in the Hindustan Times yesterday is headlined, "Pakistan's Moment of International Isolation Has Arrived." And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Aparna Pandey, welcome to you.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, you were hearing what Dean Adil Najam was saying there about the big asks that he thinks of the international community should ask of both Pakistan and India. What do you make of that? Is that the depth of the solution that we have to aim for in order to keep these two nuclear powers, away from the brink of war?
I would say that the main thing that India is looking for and has been looking for almost 7 decades now is that there should be a peaceful neighborhood. India wants a peaceful neighborhood. Every Indian prime minister, including Mr. Modi, when he came into power, sought better relations with Pakistan. He even went to Pakistan in December 2015. However, the issue of terrorism has not changed in the last 3 decades. The Pakistani state, especially the Pakistani military, has not stopped its support of and its revolving door for terrorists. And where I would differ with Dr. Najam is when he said that, you know, the Pakistani state needs to act against terrorism. However, the world was quiet. I do believe that the world actually came on India's side. And the only reason for that was that after few decades of Pakistani state saying that there is no evidence of terrorism, even when terrorists like the Mumbai terror attackers, the recent Pulwama terror attackers, when they claimed that they were behind the terrorist attacks, Pakistan still refused to take any action. If you look at the Mumbai terror attacks, India presented evidence, many other countries presented evidence, but Pakistan refuted it, saying that it is Indian evidence and India is a Pakistan enemy of Pakistan, so we will not accept that evidence. Osama bin Laden was found in a garrison town in Pakistan, and Pakistan has yet to explain how and why he was there. So I believe countries around the world actually sort of do not believe Pakistan when Pakistan says that it will act against terrorists. Until Pakistan takes those actions, it is unlikely that that will change.
Right.
Regarding Kashmir, yes.
Well, can you hold that thought for a second? Because we will. Sure. The Kashmir issues, of course, looms large in all this, and I want to explore that with you. But let me get Adil Najam back in here. I mean, you heard Aparna Pandey just list a lot of high-profile terrorism incidents that Pakistan has refused to really acknowledge in the past many years. I mean, so let's just start with that. If that's going to continue to be a sticking point, not just in the region, but globally, how to turn the Pakistani government's opinion or actions on this, especially when, in the eyes of many observers, it's the Pakistani government itself that is complicit in these actions.
And that's the question, the eyes of the observer and the government. So I don't speak for Pakistan. Yeah. I'm trying to analyze. So, you know, the thing that Aparna said about wanting a peaceful neighborhood, every Pakistani prime minister, every Pakistani military chief has said that repeatedly as the smaller nation sort of they have a bigger compulsion to. But this is not about who's right, who's wrong. On the terrorism front, I could list a longer list of terrorism in Pakistan, right? From the APS attack, from what's happening in Balochistan, from what's happened in Karachi, from what's happened in Lahore, what's happened. So, if it's going to be the bragging right is going to be being the victim of terrorism, Pakistan is much, much higher. But that's not the point. The point is, what do we really mean when we say Pakistan is involved? Is India really saying that the government of Pakistan sits and plans these attacks? I think that's, in some ways, the narrative that has been built and is convenient for certain forces, including these terrorist organizations, is that somehow the Pakistan state is complicit. And so it is one thing to say we are planting terrorism in another country. It's another thing if a state is weak and is unable to control it. India cannot control the violence that's going on in Kashmir. Pakistan has not been able to control the terrorism in Pakistan, very often by same or similar organizations. So I think the two countries need to grow up. Right. So, and rather than the war of narrative, come to some sort of a solution.
But let me ask you, and I definitely take your point and want to reiterate, you're not speaking for Pakistan here. You're providing analysis. But I do have to ask, though, I mean, does your analysis include the assertion that the Pakistani intelligence services haven't provided cover for terrorist groups based in Pakistan?
My sense is we give too much credit to intelligence agencies. This is a country that can't provide water and electricity to most people. And to assume that such sort of elaborate... Now, that does not mean... I'm not trying to say that there have clearly been occasions in going back to the Mujahideen and the U.S. supporting it with Pakistan, so on and so forth. Countries have made the mistakes of trying to play this militant card. But what I'm trying to say is there is a lot that's also out of this state's control simply because it's a very weak state by every other indicator.
Right.
Right. This assumption that on every other indicator, this is a state that struggles. But somehow on this one, right, this one thing, it is this super James Bond state that can control events all across the world, I think is funny.
Well, Aparna Pandey, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, just a quick point. Maybe the reason that the state isn't able to function on the other points is because it has really developed just one muscle, and that muscle is the military muscle. The very first budget of Pakistan in 1948, 75% of its resources went to defense. And over the decades, if we actually look, most of Pakistan's resources, most of the assistance, most of its concentration has always been defense. It's always been towards the military. And the reason is that the Pakistani state's orientation has been India. There has been a certain obsession about India on its foreign and security front. So it has overspent. It has overspent on military rather than spending on its people. And maybe that's the reason. I could go into a longer discussion, but I will stop there.
Well, and just to say, does it not make sense that for 70 years, India would be the preoccupation of Pakistan when you have an enormous nation, you know, born through hostilities, through the partition of India? I mean, like, it doesn't beggar belief that Pakistan would be preoccupied with India.
I think, Megan, you've got it exactly right. 1948 was, here's a state created with nothing, not even stools and desks. And immediately the threat from India comes, which is counting how many days it will last. So in some ways, you know, as someone who works in human development in Pakistan, the biggest tragedy is that Pakistan has become embroiled in this immense spending on defense. Now, one argument in Pakistan is that serves the Indian interest because India can outspend Pakistan on defense, which it does by a factor of 10 or so. And therefore, the strategy like the Soviet Union, we will just outspend Pakistan into it. Now, again, I think it's a silly argument. This is a subcontinent of 1.5 billion or more people. These are not childish games to play with their lives.
Aparna, what do you think? We have 30 seconds before a break.
quick. One, Indian nationalism is not centered around Pakistan. Indian nationalism is centered on its 5,000-year-old civilization. Second, Pakistan needs the hostility with vis-a-vis India. India does not. And third, seeking parity with India, which is 7 to 10 times size and about 5 to 7 times economy, does not help Pakistan. Pakistan could have chosen a territorial identity, which it didn't.
Well, Aparna Pandey and Adil Najam, stand by. Quick break here. We're talking about India and Pakistan and how close the two nuclear nations came to war last week and what to do to preserve the peace in South Asia. We'll be right back and we'll take your calls. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about how close India and Pakistan came to war last week and what it'll take to preserve peace between the two nuclear neighbors of South Asia. And let's go to the phones because our callers have been very patient. Mansi is joining us from Tampa, Florida. Mansi, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for the call.
What's your question? Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, we've been talking a lot about this conflict in terms of the terror attacks and the potential for nuclear war, the flouting of the Geneva Conventions. And what I can't seem to understand is why Kashmir is, and the military occupation of Kashmir is ignored, especially at the international level.
Right. So Mansi, thank you so much for your call. Adil Najam did mention that in the previous segment, but let me first turn to Aparna Pandey and ask about that, because this open wound of the conflict over Kashmir is the other issue that's at the heart of the problem here. So, I mean, Aparna Pandey, how would you solve that?
Kashmir is actually, I would say, a symptom of the problem between India and Pakistan. And I do believe it will be best resolved if the two countries first actually start talking to each other and having dialogue, which will then create the trust, which will enable them to talk about Kashmir. That is one part of the question. The second part is, yes, India does need to do a lot more about how it takes care of its own Kashmiri citizens. However, third, the issue of terrorism, which has come in the last few decades, has actually hurt the Kashmiris. So if the policy of the Pakistan-based jihadi groups or the Pakistani state is that the more their terror attacks or their incidents in Kashmir, it will actually help Kashmiris, that's not true. It's hurt Kashmiris. One of the reasons why there is almost no discussion of Kashmir on the international front is that Kashmir is associated with terrorism now. So maybe if the issue came back to just being that about discussing the future of Kashmir without the Damocles sword of terrorism, it may be easier to resolve the Kashmir dispute. But I would say it's one of those disputes which needs a few decades. It is not going to be solved tomorrow or the
after. 7 decades gone.
Yeah, I was going to say it's already been 70 years. But Adil Najam, can you unwind or disentangle the terrorism issue, as Aparna Pandey is bringing up here, from the dispute over Kashmir?
You can't unwind. You know, this one man, Lord Louis Mountbatten, left these two countries with the worst possible wound that has been bleeding for 70 years. And I think trying to entangle Kashmir and Kashmiris in our narratives, in these petty narratives of the two countries, we need to get above that, and neither India nor Pakistan will. You know, one of the biggest jokes, I'm a great friend of the United Nations, but one of the biggest jokes is one of the longest serving peacekeeping mission of the United Nations is the so-called observer mission in Kashmir. 70 years. Please tell us what you've observed. Please hold these two, hit them on the wrist if you need to, and say, solve this issue. And if part of that solution is an independent Kashmir, whether it's Pakistan or India, I think they're both, after 70 years, something is a symptom. If it's a symptom, let's please treat the symptom.
But Adil Najam, you and I have spoken many times over the course of several years, so you know I have a deep respect for you. But to hear you say that the issue of the disputed territory of Kashmir is a petty narrative, I mean, not the
Kashmir issue, but our other narratives, whether it is sort of the India-Pakistan narrative, the Kashmir is not petty at all. Kashmir,
okay.
I think, is the central issue. Take Kashmir out, I do not know what the two countries are fighting about.
Got it. Thank you for the clarification. I was a little confused by that. Aparna Pandey, would you like to respond to that?
Actually, I believe Kashmir is a symptom. I do not believe Kashmir is the main problem. The main issue is that neither side trusts each other. The main issue is that why don't the two countries have economic relations? Why did India offer most favored nation status in 1996 and Pakistan not respond to it? So it's not as though the two countries are talking on sort of there are no
India
other issues.
Slapped.
There are issues.
But India just closed the trade
yes,
relations.
But it
India
did
is
after
the one
how many
that
years?
Hasn't been wanting it.
Dr. Najam, after how many years? India offered it in 1996.
This is
2019.
I support you entirely. Let's have trade relations.
Yeah.
Let's have sports relations. Let's do
Absolutely.
Cricket together. Come over.
So,
we will come over. Let's not try to keep each other out of Olympics. This is what I mean by the pettiness. The pettiness is there is a tea shop in the south of India whose name happens to be Karachi Tea Shop. I think it is a tea or coffee shop. And these lynch mobs come and threaten them to take the word Karachi off. Right? And they end up...
Well,
that's, and it's on both sides. This is not
It's on
one.
Both sides. I mean,
this rhetoric of Punjab, hate has to come down.
Yeah. The Punjab information minister who spoke about Hindus just the other day.
And was kicked out of his job today.
Yep. So, I mean...
Literally today he was kicked out.
Yes.
Congratulations to me.
It is on both sides. But the question is that... Two countries which have a problem, I mean, Taiwan and China. China claims Taiwanese territory, but there is no terrorism in China-Taiwan relations. They are good. They have good economic relations. Why is that?
Mm.
The question, I mean, we should also look at other places. I mean, the question of terrorism, why does it only come in when Kashmir is involved? Why isn't that in, even before terrorism started?
That is
started,
a good question. Why does this terrorism thing keep coming up?
So in 1947... there was partition. Terrorism in Kashmir did not start in 1989. There were talks between the two countries in 1962 when the two countries had a discussion.
Very briefly,
Nehru
by 1989, three wars had been fought between the two.
No,
this is not about terrorism, this is about Kashmir.
I'm going to step in here and first of all say that I think what we're hearing is the depth of the complexity of this problem, even after 70 years. But I want to turn our attention a little bit to, given this complexity, what can and should the international community do, specifically the United States, because its posture in the region has changed rather dramatically in the past couple of years. So first of all, let's just listen to what President Donald Trump just said on Friday of last week. He was, of course, in Hanoi, Vietnam, talking about North Korea, but he did talk a little bit about the tensions between India and Pakistan, and he called it, quote, decent news that Pakistan had agreed to release without preconditions that Indian Air Force pilot that it had captured.
They've been going at it. And we've been involved in trying to have them stop. And we have some reasonably decent news. I think hopefully that's going to be coming to an end. It's been going on for a long time, decades and decades. There's a lot of dislike, unfortunately. So we've been in the middle trying to help them both out, see if we can get some organization and some peace. And I think probably that's going to be happening.
President Donald Trump last week. Now, Aparna Pandey, let me turn to you first on this, because, you know, the Pakistani ambassador to the United States last week, Asad Khan, said, we would like to have more. We would certainly like to see more active involvement of the United States. There were some phone calls made by, you know, high-ranking members of the Trump administration to both Pakistan and India. But it wasn't, as we were talking about earlier in the hour, the more sort of forthright diplomacy that the United States is able to do. Part of the reason, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the United States is in kind of a complicated situation itself here. It does still rely on Pakistan because of all of the U.S. activities in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, it's been tilting a little bit more towards India in the past several years. So what is the best role for the U.S. to play in the region right now?
I'm actually one of those who sort of supports what they did right now. I believe that the U.S. was involved behind doors. However, it did not do what it used to do traditionally, which is whenever India-Pakistan, a terror incident happened and it looked like the two countries were about to escalate, it would come in and ask both countries to sort of just back off and start a dialogue. I don't think that has helped in the past. And I do believe there was involvement. I do believe there was condemnation by almost every major country and even a statement by the UN Security Council. And I think the message sent was correct, which is that do not go to war. However, there needs to be that Pakistan needs to take action against the terror groups. So I believe that this policy of the U.S. should continue. Yes, Afghanistan may be one of the factors, but I also believe one of the factors is that a large number of countries do believe that the reason for the escalation was the terror attack, and that action needs to be taken after repeated promises of taking action against terror groups. Pakistan does need to act against the terror groups.
Mm. Adil Najam, I mean, the president, he has taken a harder line on Pakistan than we've heard from previous administrations, drawing closer to India since 2017, at least. Is that the right trajectory for the United States?
I think the United States remains distracted, particularly this president remains distracted, and I think it will. The only major country that really came in early with anything that was public was China, and even they were lukewarm. For the U.S., this is no longer just about Pakistan or even Afghanistan. There's China in the mix. This is bigger stakes. I think what the world should do, what the major powers should do, what is in the U.S. interest, but is also in China's interest, is to help both countries develop a logic for peace. Mm. That logic is staring us in our face. Here is India's moment to rise. It cannot rise while the wound of Kashmir is bleeding, while it is acting as this petty belligerent. The logic for peace for Pakistan is even more apparent. It has been bleeding. And as we talked, that has costs on human development, that has cost on the people of Pakistan. But the rest of the world needs to step in and say, we will help you build that. And both these countries, both of them, have to stop saying, no, we are not going to let anyone else interfere.
Hmm.
This is too dangerous for the world not to interfere in.
Oh, okay, so on that point, there's one more bit of insight that I hope we can gather from both of you, from you, Adil, and Aparna, and that has to do with the appetite or tolerance for hostilities domestically between these two nations. And I ask because of particularly the media in both India and Pakistan here. I want to play a little bit of tape here. Following the terror attack in Kashmir that got these latest hostilities rolling, remember that happened on February 14th, South Asian media, and this one piece of tape you'll hear, particularly in India, was very, very bellicose. So here's Indian news anchor Arnab Goswami calling for all-out revenge against Pakistan on his show, The Debate, with Arnab Goswami.
We realize how essential it is for us to crush Pakistan. No talk, no condemnation, no mercy. It is time for blood. The enemy's blood.
That's Indian TV anchor Arnab Goswami. Aparna Pandey, we also had members of the Indian media establishment tweeting strikes and more strikes, even dressing up in army fatigues on television. I mean, how much of a role does the media have to play in the escalation of tensions between these two countries?
I do believe that the media and the social media warriors, as some people call them, have hurt not only India's image, but actually added to the escalation. I do believe part of it is, in my opinion, something which has happened around the world. Media does play a bigger role. Social media plays a bigger role. And there are enough people on social media who believe that it sort of, instead of public opinion coming through every 4 to 5 years at election time, they need to send what they believe is the public opinion to their leaders. It doesn't help. It often causes problems. And I'm one of those who wishes that this does not happen. But unfortunately, we live in a day and age when we cannot stop this from happening. And we have to just find ways to work around it.
Well, Adil Najam, we've been talking about narratives throughout the course of this hour here. I mean, are these are uncontrollable narratives to a certain extent. But how much of an influence do they play on the political leaders of India and Pakistan?
They're uncontrollable only to an extent. They're also planted. And planted in a petty sense, planted in the sense that they have been encouraged on both countries. I mean, on the Indian side, there's an absolute orgy of hyper-jingoism. On the Pakistan side, it looks comparatively docile, but only by comparison. And the self-righteousness and the gloating, that's what you see on the Pakistan side. And jingoism and sort of blood and strike is what you see on the other. It has been encouraged and it has to be de-escalated too. And the role of both the politicians and of the intellectual class in de-escalating that by not feeding that frenzy is very, very important. And here's the last and most important point on this. This might be the thing that is most difficult for either country to control, right? If any country thought that they can the charge in Pakistan is that they might think that they can control militants. That's hard enough. You try to control the jingoism on the screen when it gets you ratings. And so this is really scary because this is the other, maybe the most important element of the new abnormal, as I've been calling it.
Well, Aparna Pandey, I'm going to ask the last thought from you here because the question that still lingers in my head is tensions will rise again between these two nations. And when that happens, what are the steps do you think need to be taken to be sure that it doesn't tip over this time into potential nuclear exchange?
I believe that is going to be difficult. One cannot really predict. And the reason is that as you said, we have de-escalated, but we are one terror strike away from going back to where we were a few days ago or a few weeks ago. And so I would say that the best way to avoid that would be for Pakistan this time around to actually really act against the terror groups and demonstrate that they are at least being arrested, put in prison, and some action being taken against them so that the Indian side can actually say, yes, there are grounds, Pakistan is taking action, let's resume a dialogue. Because it is impossible otherwise for India to start a dialogue unless Pakistan takes some action against the terror groups.
Well, Aparna Pandey, Director of the Initiative on the Future of India and South Asia at the Hudson Institute, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Adil Najam, Dean of the Boston University Frederick G. Pardee School of Global Studies. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Dean Najam. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Folks, go to onpointradio.org and let us know what you think about the nuclear tensions between Pakistan and India and what the role of the international community should be. You can also send us your thoughts on social media, Twitter or Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.